So I now want to introduce to you Jacques Cheminard, the president of Solidarité Progrès from Paris, France, and as you all know, I think, former presidential candidate. And he speaks on Europe's identity, the advantage of the other in the new paradigm. Jacques.
Let me start with something I had not planned to say. It is about Fidelio. It is my beloved opera, and it is the only one that I know with a happy end. Not a play like all generally worst to be played, or the best ones, not a play where you live thinking about the tragic end, the failure of the hero or heroine, challenge to do something better than them when you leave. Here in Fidelio, it's different. It's not a happy end because it ends something in a state of individual comfort, entropic comfort. But happy because it shows that when you mobilize your courage and mind, you can overcome destiny. And that is something given to us all, to all of us, because we are all human like Leonora. And not only given, but demanded from us. See what Leonora had done for her husband, she has done for humanity, bringing the people on the stage in this beautiful end. The happy end is in the future. In the future we have to create, especially in moments of life or death, like our moment of history. And the happy end of Fidelio doesn't put us to rest like the happy end of American movies. But on the contrary, demands from us to say the truth and fight for it, as if Beethoven had composed for us here and now, composed for us to be truthful. So let's be truthful and speak in plain, heavy words. Europe, as it is a dying species, a working shadow. There is no hope for European Union based on the oligarchic principle of the disadvantage of the other, the disadvantage of the nation members and people, and to the benefit of the City of London and Wall Street. There is no hope for a European Union which does not only spread oppression to other countries, but oppresses its own constituencies and economies. Therefore, our immediate mission here and now is to free Europe from its financial sharks and cultural milestones. Ironically, it is the nations that Europe submitted to its rule that should be now the key to the liberation from our oppressors. I mean the BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Not as an inward-turned group of nations, but as Narendra Modi said, as a concert of nations acting for the mutual interest and the benefit of all their partners, opening the way in the midst of the tragedy of our times to a better future based precisely on the idea that development, a true development, can only be mutual and based on the scientific achievements of human creativity. That is why we have organized this panel as an orchestra of interventions coming from various parts of humanity, a working process to play music opposed to the sound of competition and fury that prevails in our presently self-destructive world. Look at what's happening just before our eyes, and we have to stress it again. The combined process of a barbaric epidemic of human crimes in Southwest Asia and the spread of Ebola, potentially a new Black Death, a threat to our whole civilization. These two social killer diseases are not limited to a region of the world. They are spreading into the developed sector, and in particular in Europe. The jihadists from the Londonistan, and I must add the Parisistan, or the Istans in Europe, are prepared to come back to Europe, trained to rape and kill. Already in France, one of them has called his brothers and sisters to kill French civilians at random, claiming revenge against the air bombings of the Western Allies. We have played with fire, and this fire is coming back to hit us. By next December, the World Health Organization, the WHO, estimate, which is probably underestimated, is that Ebola will infect 5,000 to 10,000 human beings per week. In fact, most probably 20,000 per week, killing most of them for lack of adequate treatment and also lack of logistics in Africa. Under the rule of the British financial neocolonialism, based on human triage, the African continent is the poorest and most exploited part of the world, a situation accepted in one form or another by all European countries. And I mean this triage is accepted in a form or another by all European countries. Not to speak about the policies of isolation of the sick, which, even is justified, are meant to put a halt on trade and economic development, adding hunger to disease. But Ebola doesn't stop at borders, as it was said yesterday. It doesn't stop at borders. We have created the danger for a breakout of this epidemic across continents. It has already infected medical assistance in the United States and Spain, and it could spread into the poor layers of our own countries, a growing part of the population, due to the imposition of destructive austerity policies, and then reach most of us if nothing is done to stop it. I wanted to mention this, something which has been raised already by previous speakers, or will be developed more in depth throughout the conference, to stress that we are not faced with mere incompetence or an accident in history, but with the result of willful policies from a European oligarchy which rules from the United Kingdom, which rules from Brussels and among the leaders of all European countries. You can name Merkel, you can name Hollande, you can name Rajoy, all of them. This system of power cannot be repaired or cured. It has to be changed. You have been or will be confronted, you have been confronted here with quotes of Prince Philip of Edinburgh, or others, like the infamous one where Prince Philip hopes to revive as a virus to reduce the world population. Others can be mentioned, like John Holdren, Obama's senior advisor on science and technology issues, or the famous French, late French ecologist Jacques-Yves Cousteau, who also wished, like his British colleagues, to bring down the world population to less than 1 billion human beings. To less than 1 billion human beings. This is criminal, but it's not only a crime of a few individuals. It is a crime embedded in the British imperial system and inscribed in the institutions of the European Union as they are. Why? Because they are Malthusian. The conception of man is that of a tamed animal. On top, there are those meant to rule, and under, the rest of us to submit. Such a Malthusian thinking cannot conceive that development means a community of purpose, the common aims of humanity shared by those committed to fight for them, and not the criminal idea that you necessarily grow at the expense of others in a world of inevitably finishing resources. Europe has therefore to change to become an association of nation states committed to global world advancement, not only in Europe, global. Let us look at how Europe was generated since World War II. It was based on three main rules, and I'm sorry to say, but it was based on these three rules: financial liberalism, free trade, and the debasement of nation states. This culminated with the euro, a tool of self-induced destruction. As a result, we have, in 2014 and 2015, zero growth rates, in fact, negative physical rates, and the demand by Eurostat, European Institute of Statistics, that illegal activities be included in the gross national product of all member states. It means that prostitution, drug traffic, tobacco and alcohol smuggling will be laundered in the economy in order to increase nominally the gross national product and justify more indebtedness. The estimated collapse of the purchasing power of the average wage earners in Europe since 2002, and also here it is underestimated, the estimated collapse of this purchasing power of average wage earners in Europe since 2007 varies between 5 to 7% in France and Germany to 50% in Greece, and if you take Ukraine into account, 70% decrease. Two books written in French by Coralie Delhomme, Europe, the Disunited States, and Robert Salé, The Rape of Europe, clearly make the point, measure by measure, that the present European Union has been purposely organized to destroy the nation states and prevent the people from taking part in the real decision processes. We have been infected by the opposite, the absolute opposite, of a principled policy of the people, by the people, and for the people, as it is inscribed in the marble of the American Constitution and in Article 2 of the French Constitution. So we have been raping our own constitutions, and that's the truth we have to face. It should not be a surprise if we look at where today's European Union comes from. It is the creation of the Committee for a United Europe and of the American Committee for a United Europe, organizations through which the British and the American services channeled funds and ideas to the European Federalists. The ideas were British, and the money was a dollar. The committee was created by Alan Dulles, the head of the Wall Street branch of the American CIA, and Duncan Sandys was Winston Churchill's son-in-law. They were the godfathers of that Europe, along with a Frenchman, Henri Freinet, the arch enemy of Charles de Gaulle, who organized the elimination of Jean Moulin, who was the link between the French, the free French outside, and the French resistance inside the country. Moulin was killed on orders of Alan Dulles. The Congress for Cultural Freedom, financed through the compensation funds of the Marshall Plan, created the cultural ground to impose such a perverted Europe. Jean Monnet and Robert Schuman shared the job on behalf of their friends throughout Europe, including those actives in the corridors of the Vatican. The original sin, so to say, of the European Union is there, and the shape of the children corresponds to the wishes of those who took initially care of them. Let me say something about the state of affairs in the European press and in economic institutions, and this has to be known. On the European press, Udo Ulf Kotte, a former editor of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, one of the leading dailies in Germany, recently admitted that I have been educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. Educated to lie, to betray, and not to tell the truth to the public. And described how he was under the influence of the CIA. He said that most corporate media journalists in the United States and in Europe are so-called non-official cover working for intelligence agencies. I quote him. I quote Ulf Kotte. I think it is especially the case with British journalists because they have a much closer relationship. It is especially the case with Israeli journalists, of course, with French journalists. The German and American media try to bring war to the people in Europe, to bring war to Russia. I am very fearful of a new war in Europe. That is said by a formerly agent journalist. Well, now you understand why all these people either never publish a word about us, or when they cannot ignore us, they call us a cult, or other slanderous characterizations which evolved in time. They always invent something. These are character assassins working on behalf of the assassins, period. As for economics, French behaviorist economist Jean Tirole just got the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for economics. To make the story short, he has always claimed that the concept of a systemic crisis is meaningless, and that to regulate hedge funds or derivatives is impossible. Let's leave that to irrational idealists. After teaching at Princeton and the MIT, he has now founded, with 60 million euros from the French state and from the French banks, the Toulouse School of Economics and the Advanced Study Institute in Toulouse, both promoting, among other things, the concept of mutually assured delusion, MAD, a new definition for MAD. After all, mutually assured delusion, it's a good word to call the present European groupthink, as he himself calls it. Let's now put our choice in blunt terms. Will Europe and Spain be the bridge for a positive development of Eurasia into Africa, or will they rather be the bridge of the death march of Ebola into the center of Europe? Will Germany, France, Italy, and other European countries recover their humanist impulse? Or will they continue to spread the opposite on behalf of the British Empire? Are we determined to throw the idiocy of geopolitics and deductive thinking, which is the way most of us think? Are we decided to throw this idiocy to the river and to become once again explorers and discoverers? Are we ready to jump out of the false ideology, the false economic dilemma, opposing the Keynesian monetarism of money foggers, monetarist diarrhea on one side, to the orthodox cult of money compressors and wealth grabbers monetary constipation on the other side, the French and German politicians may recognize themselves in the present toilet room of world politics. These are the real questions in the real world. What was Europe in 14 and 11? A region whose development was at a relatively much lower level than that of China and India. Among the 10 major cities in the world, there was in 14 and 11 only one European city, Paris, which at most 200,000 inhabitants, while Beijing had at least 600,000, and probably much more, and Baghdad had more. Paris was then a small exception in a small Europe. Even in 1792-1793, Lord Macartney, who was sent for an exploration in China and India, described the power and number of the Chinese as a threat for the developing British Empire, suggesting that something has to be done about that. There were really too many of them on Earth. He wrote that in plain words. So what has made the success of Europe afterwards? What made the success of Europe afterwards? In real terms, the Renaissance and its revolution in science and art. The Renaissance of Kusa, Kepler, Leibniz, the Renaissance of Leonardo and Beethoven, of Rembrandt and Bach, the Renaissance of Louis XI in France. The idea of a homo universalis, a human being evolving above the animal species, not because of his power to dominate, but because of his capacity to create and to awaken his self-conscience. Unfortunately, instead of sharing that capacity, Europe, under the rule of its oligarchy, betrayed its own sense of universality, and the empires, either Venetian or Dutch or British, Dutch-British, the empires used the potential created by the Renaissance on their own behalf and against other regions of the world, looting, destruction, and bestiality to cover with the technological applications of scientific discoveries, not to launch an era of mutual development, but for the sake of power and possession. What was developed in the United States as the best of Europe, the Leibnizian principles of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and not life, liberty, and property, pursuit of happiness and not property, was destroyed during the late 20th century since the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and in particular since the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Europeans and Americans, our mission is therefore to recover the founding principles inscribed in the American Constitution, and for us in Europe, to recover the principles of the 1648 Peace of Westphalia, as it was said again and again yesterday. It is precisely what Tony Blair calls to suppress in his famous Chicago speech of 1999, which was to be followed by the so-called war against terrorism, which is nothing but a war to terrorize people and to pit all against all. The Peace of Westphalia was based on three main commitments: the forgiveness of past offenses, including what was considered as a main offense, debt incurred to finance wars. That was the first commitment, the first principle. Second was the advantage of the other to prevent wars from bursting and make gains at the expense of the other. And then the third was the upholding of the principle of national sovereignty based on mutual respect. This is precisely what was thrown to the river by the present European Union, which is neither European nor a union. So where are we going to find the impulse of our recovery? In those who have better kept our principles, even if it is imperfectly. I mean, yes, the BRICS. In the words of Modi, let's make development a mass movement, just like Mahatma Gandhi made the freedom of movement a mass movement. This is a paradox of our present moment of history. We have lost our principles in Europe and the United States. And the only way to recover them is to be inspired by the motion of the BRICS, which have been created in defense against our mistakes and our crimes, against the oligarchic financial oppression, spreading murder and destruction of the whole social fabric. In order to do that, we have to free ourselves once and for all of the British oligarchy and its backup troops, in particular in the United States and also in our own countries. This doesn't mean that we have nothing to bring to the wedding basket. I do not believe that the school of British historians, the Gibbons and the Toynbees, I don't believe in the fatality of a decline, in the pursuit of a great degeneration. I believe that the more the danger grows, the more that saves is at hand, provided that we mobilize ourselves for the future of humanity beyond Europe itself. And if Europe, since the end of World War II, did something worth remembering, it has been to make peace among European nations, even though it was on the basis of a compromise with the oligarchy. Now, we have to clean up our acts at home and get rid of the oligarchic infection. You cannot organize a peaceful home with cockroaches and beetles inside. It is now time to clean our house and act, not for ourselves, but for the advantage of the other people. We need to disinfect ourselves and to jump ahead together with one impulse, not only to join the BRICS, but to inspire the development of the future. Our immediate challenge is not only to prevent horrible things from happening, but to make good things happen derived from new principles. A historical example gives me hope. In fact, it is not one, but two, and I could say even three. First, that of Anton Wilhelm Amo, a young African gentleman from Ghana, adopted circa 1707 by the Duke of Brunswick-Wolfenbüttel and treated as a member of the family. He went to the universities of Halle, Wittenberg, then Jena, studying logics, metaphysics, physiology, astronomy, history, law, theology, politics, and medicine, and mastered six languages. His own language is not even mentioned in the history books, but in fact, he mastered seven languages, his own: English, French, Dutch, Latin, Greek, and obviously German. In 1729, he wrote a memoir on de jure mororum in Europa, which he vindicates the right for blacks to be treated the same as other Europeans. He earned his doctorate in philosophy at Wittenberg in 1734. His remarkable thesis on the absence of sensation in the human mind and its presence in our organic and living body is against Cartesian dualism and develops a Leibnizian conception of humanity based on the discovery of principles and the elaboration of ideas beyond sensual perception. He returned to his birthplace when Germany turned sour and died under the custody in a Dutch fortress in Ghana. Abbot Grégoire praises him, the French humanist Abbot Grégoire, praises him in his Notice des Nègres et des Mulâtres distingués par leurs talents et leurs ouvrages, on the intellectual achievements of black authors. And Amo was also a key reference for Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana. The other case in the 18th century is that of Abraham Petrovich Ganibal, a black child adopted and freed by Russian Tsar Peter the Great, who had a glorious career in Russia as an engineer, an officer, married into the nobility, and had generations of descendants, among them, obviously, his great son, Alexander Pushkin. These two cases, And the third one would be the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, a French musician from the West Indies. These two cases prove that when European individuals decide to respect the advantage of the other, things like that can happen, and it is a ray of light from the past into the future. Today, we are far from having extended to all Africans such a recognition of their humanity. We are doing the reverse. We let them die, or we treat them as animals. And it is a challenge for us all to achieve that as an expression of our rebirth. Because Europe, as they have tried to impose it upon us, has no future. Europe as it is has no future. It is finished as a financial powerhouse located on a limited region of the world under British tutorship. But the nation states composing Europe have to be revived, like voices in a choir of instruments, or instruments in an orchestra, in a choir, like voices in a choir of human beings, or instruments in an orchestra, sovereign in serving the advantage of all. Let's think of it as a matter of life or death. It is a matter of life or death, and we have all in this room, and well beyond, we have all to understand the danger better, to understand the danger better than in my own written words. Death. If we keep behaving like we do, our destiny is to die. Either we could all die in a war, or Ebola would kill us, or we could be destroyed by the coming waves of austerity. It is here and now, and the result is the same, a planned mass extermination. But let's think about peace. Peace with a contribution of all European nations. Life means first to stop the confrontation against the East, to stop the confrontation against Russia, China, Iran. And second, to launch a credit policy for the infrastructure of world peace, a new Silk Road around the world. Think about it as a European choir, a European chorus, a Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, an Eurasia from Lisbon to Vladivostok and the Sea of China. Germany bringing its steel and machine tool capacity, with the addition of Switzerland and Austria. France, its atomic energy capacity, fission, the fourth generation of fission and fusion. And both France and Germany united with Russia, China, and the United States in a space project for which we have the people expecting our mobilization. We have the people in Darmstadt and Toulouse. Think about the South as a bridge towards Africa with Italy and Spain. Think about the North with Sweden, Denmark, and Finland as a bridge towards the East. Think of all the nations that I did not mention. Think also about them. It is a combination of an incredible potential for peace, an incredible potential for peace. It is the key to open the gates of the future, and we are missing it with our culture of death, as once Pope John Paul II characterized our culture, as a culture of death and of deadly inaction or non-action, and our permanent sin of omission and pessimism. European nations can only survive by committing themselves to drop their social bad habits, practices, and opinions of the last 100 years, and by mustering the optimism necessary to reject a culture of death, to stop this confrontation with Russia and create peace through a common development, which is a matter of life or death. To be human is not to look at yourself in a mirror like a narcissist oligarch, but to look at yourself from the future, to look at yourself improving the condition of mankind. Europe has no future as a soiled world, but has a right to claim it as an assembly of good minds in sovereign republics. Here we are in this room, and I am sure that we are going to be enriched by the next speakers with thoughts coming from the future. Let then free ourselves from the deadly embrace of the City of London, Wall Street, and the British Empire. And let's say and mean it, long live to a new Silk Road around the whole earth. Long live free Europe. Long live Eurasia from the Atlantic to the Sea of China. Long live free Germany. Long live free France. Vive les États-Unis de Franklin, Lincoln, Roosevelt et Larouche. Vive les États-Unis libres, libérés de la tutelle impériale britannique, freed from British imperial domination. We can all freely breathe the open air, provided we put our lives at stake to reach into the future. It is in our hands, as Helga said yesterday, it is in our hands because it is our mission, and the people, I am fully convinced of it, the people is waiting to come on the stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jacques.